Hello and welcome to She Means the World.
And
I'm Kai, and we have Emily as usual.
We have Dr.
This week,
we'll
be talking to Dr. Welcome. Kathy Powers, and she teaches.
Let's start off. Can you just tell us a little bit about
your career trajectory?
So
we'll
let
her tell her own story.
Sure. So I'll tell you, I guess, who I am now, and then start from the beginning of how I got here. I am an associate professor at the University of New Mexico and an adjunct professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown. I also hold appointments in the School of Law at the University of New Mexico, the Program of Africana Studies there, and the Health Policy Center. I'm a senior fellow. I should probably mention I'm an African-American woman who studies international relations using quantitative methods primarily, that would be math and statistics. I focus on the role of international organizations in international law and world politics. Early in my career as an international trade expert who tried to understand the relationship between trade institutions and war. When I say trade institutions, I mean regional economic institutions like the European Union, NAFTA, Mercosur in Latin America, ECOWAS in West Africa. And then more recently, my work is focusing on in the aftermath of mass human rights violations globally, reparations efforts that emerge, and with the goal of, in most cases, not all, justice for the victims who suffered horrific human rights violations like genocide, torture, sexual violence, for example. And I'm interested in why some victims seek reparations and others don't, why some efforts are awarded and others aren't, which means that I'm interested in sort of the global institutional and legal landscape of reparation seeking. So if you're a victim of a human rights violation, where do you start? What recourse do you have within your country? Regional human rights courts, international courts, treaties, public policies. There's lots of different mechanisms. And so I'm writing a book right now, mapping all of this out from the point of, if you suffer a human rights violation, sort of what are your options and the legal and institutional issues that arise. Okay, so how did I get here? Is probably the most interesting part, because I don't have this traditional background of an academic. So I am, I will say this because it's important given where I came from. As far as anyone knows, and it's important that I say it this way, as far as we know, I'm the first African-American woman to be tenured in quantitative international relations and political science in the country. That means who we know of. There's very few of us who study international relations using these tools. And we're in the process of trying to sort of get information about everyone else that's out there. So I was tenured in 2013, and since there are three or four more women, black women who've been tenured. So this is, it's great that we have more. It's sad that I was the first. It means that there were people who came before me, and for varied reasons, were not able to make it to tenure. Okay, so I'm from the inner city of Cleveland, from a working class neighborhood. My parents, my dad, my mom stayed home. My dad was a Greyhound bus driver for a very long time. I think he represents the American dream, because in his 50s, when Greyhound was on strike, he went to work for the city of Cleveland, plowing snow in the winter, and moved up to management by the time he retired in his 60s. So I sort of grew up, and this is important for when people ask, how do you maintain positions, jobs at two institutions in two different parts of the country? And it's because I grew up with parents who worked very, very hard, both of them, and they both often at different points in their life held multiple jobs at one time to make sure that our family kept going. So I have one brother, five sisters, and had a very good childhood. You know, with two parents at home, what our struggle was more economic. My dad was often on, Greyhound bus drivers would go on strike fairly often because Greyhound would often cut their wages, so we had periods where he was out of work. I was very fortunate, though, because my mom was determined that we would go to private schools because the public schools in the neighborhood where I grew up were incredibly dangerous. Not only was there a lot of drugs, female students would often be beat up and raped in the bathrooms in school. The quality of education at that time wasn't great. And so my mom always knew about these sort of elite private schools and wanted us to go there. So I went to Catholic schools throughout my childhood, all the way through high school. My high school was a very prestigious high school. It's called Gilmore Academy. And my sisters and I, so three of us, went there. And we did work study to help pay our tuition. And work study included being part of the cleaning crew there. So we cleaned after the students we went to school with to pay our tuition. And I always held several other jobs. Eventually, we moved up to the business office. But what was, it was difficult because I cleaned up after the students I went to school with. I also had other jobs on the weekend, and I played sports. I played basketball, and I was active in other activities as well. So were my sisters. But what it did was it took away the question of whether we were going to college to where we were going to college. And so the great thing about my parents was it wasn't a question of whether we would go. It was where we were going to go. And I'm not even sure, like, if you should do this today or not, but it was what's the best school that you could get into, and also the most financial aid that we could get. Because I always knew at age 5, my mom told us that we had to pay, you have to be out of here at 18, and you have to pay for your own education. It's like what they could do, they did in terms of high school, what they could pay. We did work study for the rest, and then it was, you have to go to college, and you have to pay for it. And so it became really important about the financial aid packages and things like that. So I did my undergrad at Northwestern University, where I double majored in international relations and political science with a focus on East Asia, primarily Japan. Okay, so how did that happen? So when I get to college, I'm like, I'm interested in everything but the U.S., only because I just wanted to learn more about what was out in the world. I also grew up during the Cold War, so I was obsessed with my security. I was obsessed with the nuclear war, chances of a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. And at the same time, I was concerned about drug violence and gang violence. And so I thought there was an equal probability that I would be killed by either or both. And wrote extensively about this when I was in elementary school and high school. So when I learned about the rising Japanese economic power, I thought that was fascinating. So I get to college. I decide I'm going to be an international corporate lawyer. I have no idea what that means, but I knew that lawyers use the tools of law to help people, and it was a way to also earn a good income. So that's sort of, and I didn't know what corporate lawyers did, but I had a sense that that could get me to Japan. And so I wanted to be an international corporate lawyer who practiced in Japan. So I'd also, while I was in high school, I did summer programs at the University of Akron and at Case Western Reserve University, which was like 5 minutes away from where I lived. And they were all legal programs to expose you to law. And I had gotten into Case Western Reserve University with a scholarship that paid for, I would have done my undergrad and was already accepted into the law school. Today, Case Western Reserve law professors created the Saddam Hussein War Crimes Tribunal. They specialize in war crimes law. And I did not go because I wanted to get out of Cleveland and see what else there was in the world. So that's how I ended up at Northwestern. And so I started taking Japanese right away. I took a lot of things that I would recommend no one ever does. Japanese economics calculus, which is not the best freshman lineup that you could have. But I didn't care about how difficult things were. I just wanted to learn. Which there are much better ways for your GPA, I learned later, to organize a schedule. And so while I was an undergraduate, I had odd jobs, and I saw an advertisement for a research assistant in the program of African Studies. And so I was curious about research. I was starting to question law. I didn't know all the different kinds of law you could do, but I didn't want to represent people that hurt people. And so I was trying to find a way, how can I come up with a career that utilizes my strengths and also I can help the world in some way. So I said, let's see what this research thing was about. And it turned out the program of Africana Studies there was the number one Africana Studies program in the country and the largest African collection outside of Africa, the African continent on the planet. And so I had a chance to do research for some of the top Africanists on the planet who got fellowships and came to Northwestern to do research. And I just thought it was really, really cool to be on the forefront of new knowledge and to think about how do you use it to help society teach and do research. And all of my professors across all areas did research, teaching, and service, but they also were practitioners at the same time in whatever field they worked in, and that's what attracted me to academia. So I think it was maybe the summer after my junior year, a few months before that, I was walking down a hall and I saw another sign that said, research experience for undergraduates at the State University of New York. I was like, I have no idea what this is, but it sounds kind of cool. So I applied and I got in. And basically what REU programs are, they're funded by the National Science Foundation. And it's to take undergraduates for a summer and pay them to do research. And oftentimes to produce a research paper at the end and you present it in a conference that they have as part of the program. And it's a way to expose you to what academic research is like in an area that you might be interested in. So I had a great experience that summer and doing research, and I thought, this is great. And I was recruited out of that program to Stony Brook's graduate program in political science. So I went there and so the next year is my senior year. I spent another summer there doing research. And then 2 days after I graduated from undergrad, I went to Stony Brook this summer research and I started a PhD program. Okay, so let's stop for a second with that part. On one hand, it worked out well. I was able to start a PhD very young. I was awarded a full fellowship to go to graduate school. It was also a time of a recession, and there were very few jobs. And since I knew I wanted to do this, I did it. At the same time, if I can make a recommendation, I would say don't do that. Because I think you need a break in between undergrad and grad. And by break, I mean like a job that pays the bills is not necessarily exactly what you want. You have evenings and weekends free because you need time for your mind and your body to make sense of the undergraduate work you just did, to take a break. Because once you start graduate school, law school, business school, you will work hard, you will create opportunities, and it will be more difficult to slow down as you go along. It also gives you a chance to sort of look around. It all worked out for me, and I love what I do. But a little break where I wasn't working so intensely from then until now would have been great. So I did my graduate work there, focusing in American politics and how American political factors impact how Congress votes on international trade legislation. And it's a program that is very good at quantitative international relations, quantitative political science. And while I was there, it was great, but I realized I was more interested in international relations questions than just how Congress voted on international trade legislation, and realized I was interested in how does international trade work? what is the relationship between trade and war? Economic liberals argue that the more countries trade with each other, the less likely they are to fight each other because they don't want to risk access to those markets. But it doesn't take into account inequalities, historical rivalries. And one of the things that I found in my work was that countries who trade also fight. So I wanted to explore that a little bit more. And left Stony Brook with a master's degree and went to Ohio State University and did a PhD in international relations, focusing in international political economy, international security, and methodology. And so I collected one of the first databases of the military characteristics of trade agreements, which was unknown because the assumption was countries who trade don't fight. So no one expected that in the design of their agreements or the organizations that they would have military forces, that they would have peacekeeping forces, that they would have military alliances, early warning systems on the ground, like in the Karamoja cluster in East Africa, where you have teenagers who are shepherds who have AK-47s who will fight over grazing land. And these regional trade organizations are monitoring the level of violence so that it doesn't draw in states and turn into a conflict between states or a regional conflict, potentially a global conflict.
In that case, how would they intervene to prevent
so,
that from happening?
So they actually have offices near the grazing areas. And when the violence starts, if it starts involving more and more people, more and more territory, then they alert bureaucrats who are higher up in organizations like COMESA, the African Union, the United Nations, that this is a place where the intensity of conflict is increasing and we should watch it. And that's when they'll start notifying the leaders of the countries, creating conferences or opportunities for negotiations to talk, to figure out how to disarm, how to solve the problems that are leading to the conflict rather than letting it fester. So it's really interesting because traditional notions of security were countries fighting each other over territory, over resources, over political issues, not recognizing that countries were fighting or individuals were fighting over these sorts of issues, common pool resources, and then bringing in states. That you had the South Asian Regional Commission, in which India and Pakistan are members, and they're constantly fighting each other and constantly trading with each other. And so they would open up new roads that would allow labor to go back and forth, and they're still fighting with each other. So the cost of everything is going up because of the security implications. And so what I'm describing had largely been a global South phenomena that had been overlooked because the study of international trade was largely the United States and Western Europe. So while I was doing this, I actually left graduate school early. I have life-threatening asthma. And I left right after my dissertation proposal defense, and I was really fortunate that I got a job as a visiting instructor at the University of Arizona. So I wrote my dissertation, collected my data, wrote my dissertation while I worked full-time at another university. And while I was doing this, I was teaching a little similar to other faculty. And I had a student in one of my classes who was African-American and Jewish. And he took my international political economy class, and he said, I want to write a paper on why my Jewish grandmother got reparations for the Holocaust, but my African-American grandmother did not for slavery. And I knew very little about reparations. I knew about the African-American reparations debate. I knew about the Holocaust. I knew a little bit about reparations for the internment of Japanese people. But I had no idea that there were cases around the world. So I told him, I said, okay, if you're going to do this in an international class, you have to go and find some cases and find some law for me. And he did, and he wrote a paper about it. And that was 18 years ago in 2000. And it started me on this project of trying to understand human rights and reparations a very profound question. I remember when he was in my office, I said, why some and not others? So I wasn't a human rights expert. I was an international political economy person. So I used my classes and I brought in human rights experts to talk about these issues. And then I would lecture on the economic consequences. And it was a side project while I was working on the trade stuff. And I got a job at Penn State University and went there and I got my first grant to start collecting data on reparations efforts, which really jump-started the project. And I don't know how much further you want me to go. Okay, so I'll keep going until I get to the present. So my lungs had gotten stronger. I had heard stories that if you went to the Southwest and had a break from what was killing me was the drastic weather changes. So, you know, the temperature drops 40 degrees in like 30 minutes in the Midwest, and I would just turn blue and my airways would shut down. So, but I had done really well for almost 5 years in the Southwest. I had an invitation to apply to Penn State. I did. I didn't think I'd get the job, and I got the job. And I thought I'd take a chance and go back to the Midwest because then I would be closer to my family in Cleveland. And it gave me an opportunity to start this project while I was still working on the other. And I could not handle living in Pennsylvania. I was told by doctors I probably wouldn't live through the winter if I stayed.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. And so, yeah, at the time I was single. So here I go again. I have to move across the country again. And the university, let me be clear, my time at the University of Arizona was absolutely wonderful. I took a chance on going to Penn State because it was closer to family. And it was an opportunity to start working on these other research projects that I had. So 3 years in, I'm in the same situation where I have to pick up with two bags, hope that I survive the flight to the Southwest. To make a long story short, my colleagues at Pennsylvania sent emails out saying that I was on the market. And the University of New Mexico got one of those emails and invited me for a talk. And to make a long story short, like, I got the job. But because I had to leave so suddenly from Penn State, I took a medical leave. The University of Arizona was wonderful. They let me come there for the medical leave and gave me office space. I was still a Penn State employee. And I did research. But I started thinking, maybe this academic career is not for me. Because I have these health issues I have to manage, the academic market is the country. Because there's so few universities. Maybe I need to think more about a profession where I can move around a single state and stop risking my life over and over again to be in this profession because I enjoy it so much. And so while I was on a leave at the University of Arizona, I took a class in the law school. And it was absolutely wonderful. And instead of it sort of convincing me to go to law school, it created a new research or an area of knowledge now that I apply in my research. So I took a class on public international law to understand treaties, international organizations, relationships between states under law, and learn about different concepts like legal personality, the exhaustion of domestic resources, and I learned these legal concepts that actually helped me think about if I'm interested in international organizations and law, what are the conditions under which international organizations are legal persons with their own rights and obligations separate from the countries that are members of them? So if an international organization is accused of a human rights violation, does that claim go towards the member states? Or the organization, like we think about corporations, legal claims go against the corporation, not the shareholders. So I was able to use this class and the legal concepts that I learned about and apply it to my research to understand when we see non-state actors, meaning actors that are not countries, individuals, and international organizations, and their role in the reparations process. When they are injured, where can they seek reparations in an international legal system that is largely historically state-centric, focusing on governments? So, for instance, the International Court of Justice, governments can bring claims, but individuals and international organizations can't. So when they suffer human rights violations, they have no domestic recourse. Where can they go in international relations? And so much has changed, especially since the 1990s, with regional human rights courts that have emerged, legal opinions that say that international organizations have rights to reparations under particular instances. Individuals have access to venues now where they can seek reparations, depending on the human rights courts to which their country belongs to. So there still is a state-centric component. So that class was huge for all of my research. It was great. And meanwhile, to make a long story short, I got the job at the University of Arizona, the University of New Mexico, which gave me the opportunity to start using legal theories, legal, international legal scholarship to think about what constitutes authority and independence of non-state actors in international relations, and how does that then have an impact on reparations seeking an award in international relations. So I come to the University of New Mexico. The department was very supportive of everything that I'd done. If you're counting, that means I have a really long path. So I started out very young, but it took 8 years for me to get the PhD. Because of negotiating my tenure clock term back at each university, total took me 13 years to get tenure. The typical path is 6 to 8 years. So it was a very big deal when I got it, because I wasn't sure I could even stay in the profession given the things that had happened to me. So I got tenure. Life is good. I was able to revamp myself, redefine myself as a human rights scholar and a scholar of international organizations. So if I can say something about social media has become very important for academics, not only to talk about our work, share our work with the public, but also it was a quick way to redefine myself. So when I started talking about my work on reparations, suddenly journals started asking me to review more and more human rights articles as opposed to, and I still do trade articles, for example. So it was huge. So right after tenure, which is important about how I got to Georgetown, because it's very unusual. It is not unusual that professors hold, it can happen that you hold multiple appointments. So how did it happen for me? It is not common for women, for female scholars, to have multiple appointments the way it is for men. The opportunities often don't happen. We actually don't go for things because we have to be concerned about how do these sorts of career choices that take you away from your family have an impact. So I'm going to talk about that because it's I think it's important for the sorts of things I'm thinking about now. And like, how do you do the things in academia that we're told we should do that are considered prestigious or support your work? But how is it different for men versus women? So when I was at the University of Arizona, am I getting controversial?
No, this is like exactly what we want to get into.
Okay, so sorry, I could go back because I could talk about in the areas that I've worked, especially international political economy conflict. At the time that I did it, not only were there no minorities, there were very few women. And the women who were senior to me when I was in graduate school are only about 5 years older than me. So in my stats classes at the time, I was one of few. In my formal modeling and mathematical modeling classes, I was often the only woman and minority. And sometimes there were a few other people in the class. When I went to conferences, the smaller ones, I was oftentimes, if a few other people didn't show up, the only minority person in the entire conference, and sometimes one of few women. So the feel, yes.
As a result of that, like, did you feel the experience a lot of bias? Like, did you, like, was the climate, like...
Yeah. So what I was up against is, which is interesting, is a stereotype that African Americans don't do international relations. So there are a lot of where minorities in general, African Americans in particular, broke into political science in the 1950s and 60s was American politics during race and ethnicity. And so at the time, no matter what you did, that's what you were sort of hired for. So it was unusual. It was, so not just that I'm a minority and a woman, but how could she know international relations was sort of what I was up against. And so I did have experiences in graduate school and early in my career where I would be on panels and discussants would talk about everyone's paper except mine and then just end the panel while I'm sitting right there. I've had the experience of the research agenda I have. One of the things I guess I'm known for is doing innovative work. I see sort of things, phenomenon coming before people realize in this particular area we should be paying attention to it. So the battles I faced is to demonstrate that, you know, these military characteristics and trade agreements are, they're actually happening and they're important. And just because they started with Africa doesn't mean that they're not important for the entire world. And I started there and found them throughout the global South. And then now we see regional trade agreements in the West having security features about them. But it was me saying it. And so it took a long time. And also I didn't frame it well. So it took me a while to say this phenomenon is important to political science in this area in this way. The reparation stuff was really hard. I'd started working on it in 2000, but one of my mentors, Christian Davenport, and I started trying to think about, okay, what is a strategy for studying reparations and thinking about it globally and locally? And it's every time you say the word as an African American, and I have dreadlocks, it's, she's talking about, she's just an advocate African American reparations. Which is frustrating, because if anybody else had said that this is a global phenomenon that has domestic and international implications, the burden of demonstrating its importance to international relations scholars would not have been as great. And it took until my third year review at the University of New Mexico, which is very strong in civil conflict, civil war settlement, human rights, when I wrote my statement of my research, where people realized, wow, she said in the aftermath of civil war meaning war between governments and groups, or between two groups, or between two groups who are from different countries, which was spreading across the planet starting in the 1990s. So we had civil conflicts. 95% of the conflicts on the planet were civil conflicts. Then in the aftermath of this, reparations are being used to deal with the issues of justice, rehabilitation, and compensation for the victims. And it wasn't until I could connect it, they saw the connection to civil war, that they said, oh, this is an issue that international relations scholars should pay attention to. Also, you know, if you talk about human rights abroad, Americans are okay. If you talk about human rights issues in the United States, it's very difficult to have that conversation. So I can, if I talk about reparations in the sense of reparations in Nepal for the Maoist communist rebels who took land and committed horrific atrocities towards people, and the national military who did it, and the reparations in the aftermath, we can have that conversation. Or if I talk about Sierra Leone, where individuals' hands and feet were cut off so that they couldn't walk, they couldn't work, they couldn't vote, and reparations as prosthetics, or psychological or medical care as reparations, we can have that conversation. But if we talk about Chicago torture in the United States, which is there were police commander, a police commander had black sites on the south side and west side of Chicago, tortured 100 African-American men, plus smaller numbers of Hispanic and poor white men. And the torture tactics were from Vietnam. And this was from 1971 to 1992, I think. And so it's the first case of reparations for police brutality in U.S. history, and it happened less than a year ago. And the lawyers modeled the legal reasoning in the case after international cases like Chile, Argentina, South Africa. They started using the term human rights. They said that these acts constitute torture under the Convention on Torture, and they won. So historically, the United States has had a huge impact on human rights-seeking strategies globally. And because the rest of the world is so much further along, especially the Global South, because they were plagued with civil conflicts, of thinking about what was the harm that was committed and how might we be creative about creating reparations. So it took me and my co-authors and the pieces that I've done going outside of the U.S. and doing sort of these global studies to show that this is a phenomenon that has spread across the planet. So international relations scholars are paying attention to. This is the globe, and these individual things are happening. Wow, there's reparations here, there's reparations there. Are these unique individual things in their own country, history, language, historical context, geographic context, or is there some factors that are leading to a pattern of these things across the planet? And so that's what my work was able to sort of demonstrate. So after tenure, my brain was tired because I never had a break. And it was a long path. And the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington, D.C. does a lot of collaborative work trying to connect the Holocaust to current events of human rights violations and genocide to figure out what we could learn, take the lessons from the Holocaust that might be applied. And it contacted, I had no part in this, the University of New Mexico to co-sponsor a workshop on the implications of the Holocaust for human rights issues in the Southwest. And one of my senior mentors said, well, why don't you present your reparation stuff? And it wasn't political science. I could just talk about it. It was great. And I did. And to make a long story short, the Holocaust Museum had research fellowships. And I applied for one for my sabbatical. And a sabbatical, you get every 7 years. The first one is after you get tenure. And it's not that you just get to sit and rest. You propose a research project that you have to do, which you get time off from teaching to do. So it brought me to Washington, D.C., and I worked on a project on the role of international organizations in Holocaust restitution. So the history that has been lost is, it is a seminal case that we must pay attention to because you had victims spread across the planet who are now refugees that are going to be settled, and the world said we must figure out what countries are willing to accept them and under what conditions. And new international organizations were developed to deal with refugee resettlement. The United Restitution Organization that had offices in 29 countries just to help victims fill out the application for reparations because they were illiterate and they were unable to be, Hitler didn't allow them to be educated. So you have global coordination, which is very important for thinking about the Syrian refugee crisis today, where countries voluntarily took Holocaust victims for varied reasons, assuming that they would bring reparations with them. So you have a new institutional and legal landscape in the world of institutions that are moving people, helping people across national borders who refuse to go back to Germany because of what happened to them. And so I mapped out the institutional and legal landscape. So what did you want to ask?
Yeah. So Speaking of that, do you find that there are like different conditions under which countries are more willing to take refugees?
So I don't think there has been enough study of conditionality of refugee resettlement agreements. And let me give you an example. And I know we talked about this. So President Trujillo of the Dominican Republic admired Hitler. And he had his own final solution. He said that Haitian immigration was destabilizing politically, economically, and socially to the Dominican Republic. And so he used the national military to go door to door. And he used the word for parsley, either pronounced with a French accent or Spanish accent, to distinguish between people who were from the Dominican Republic and people who were Haitian. And if you said it with a French accent, they had machetes and they slaughtered people. Hundreds of thousands of people in a matter of days. And about a year later, they realized that they had killed the farmers. That he had killed the farmers. And so the Dominican Republic was one of the first countries to accept Holocaust refugees to replace the farmers. It was also, I learned this at the Holocaust Museum, I didn't know this. It was also gendered because the Dominican Republic, Trujillo, allowed mostly men in, but not women, hoping that they would marry Dominican women and lighten the population. He was obsessed with colorism. He wore powder on his face to be lighter. So he systematically used these refugee flows to try to change the population. So one of the things I think we need to consider today with the refugee resettlement agreements that are happening for Syrian refugees and climate migrants, refugees of conflict, are what are the conditions under which they're being brought in or not, that we may not find out for 20 to 50 years. So one of the reasons why I went to the Holocaust Museum was, so I'm someone who's trained to work with, in the political science context, big data sets and look for patterns and try to see if that explains something about political behavior in some way. But what I realized, we didn't understand where you could look for reparations just to know the landscape just of the Holocaust. Is it legal claims, public policies, international treaties, NGOs giving reparations to individuals like the Jewish Services Organization that took it upon itself to take the assets of Holocaust victims who were killed and had no heirs and liquidated them and gave them as reparations to Israeli refugees. And so I felt like I had to stop, learn about a seminal case, use qualitative methods, do some archival research, which I had never done before, and come back and try to make sense of all the information and data out there and have a better understanding of how this works. And that's what it did for me. Also, I haven't mentioned names of people. I don't know if I should, but I've benefited from so many mentors. Maybe I should just have a list at the end. So, I mean, along the way, there's Wendy Hansen, who mentored me at Stony Brook, Brian Pollins, Ed Mansfield, Jan Box-Evansmeyer, who are on my dissertation committee at Ohio State, Bill Dixon and Gary Gertz, who are my mentors at Arizona. You know, and then Wendy's back because she's at the University of New Mexico, and Bill Stanley. I mean, just lots of people at the University of New Mexico. This becomes important because Charles King at Georgetown found out about my work because his wife, Maggie Paxson, participated in the workshop at the University of New Mexico that was co-sponsored by the Holocaust Museum and UNM. And when I got to the Holocaust Museum, he said, why don't you come to Georgetown and give a talk? I was like, okay, bucket list item crossed off about your research. And when I came, the speaker series had already been set, so I couldn't do a traditional research talk. So he invited me to speak in his undergrad class. And Jim Vreeland there also found out I did work on international organizations. He's like, why don't you give a talk in my class? So people, you know, were saying, yeah, but you know, that's teaching. Do you want to give a teaching talk? Should you wait and do research? And I was like, this is Georgetown. I'm going. This is going to be awesome. And I get to talk about my work. And I had a fabulous time speaking to their students. One was a class on ethnicity, race, and nation. The other was international organizations. I talked about my work on reparations in both contexts. So it went well. Because there could have been an opportunity to apply for a job, permanent job at Georgetown, but because of my health situation, I can't live in Washington, D.C. permanently. I can come here now because of good medications now for short periods of time. So was, well, you're tenured at UNM. Let's explore what some kind of joint relationship looks like. So I started coming here a couple weeks out of each semester to teach. And that's how it happened. So this is my third year now. I started out co-teaching a class with Charles King. And then last spring and right now is the first time I'm teaching my own class at Georgetown. While I maintain my classes at UNM and I'm the new graduate director in the political science department.
Yeah.
So there you go. Oh, and I have two children who are 8 and 7. So we could talk about having babies along the way, too, if you like.
Well, I mean, when I took your class last semester, it seemed like you were doing like a million different projects. What are you working on now?
Okay, so now I'm really focused on the book that I'm writing. And it's called Making Amends, The New Global Politics of New Politics of Global Reparations. And the book, the first half of it, explores in international relations, what are reparations? How have they been used? How has the definition and usage changed over time? If you consider since 1952, with the reparations agreement between Israel and Germany, international law and norms about human rights have evolved. And over time, more and more acts are now categorized as human rights violations and war crimes. And more of these reparations are applied to. So I wish you could see this. So it's like increased over time. So what I'm mapping out is then what are the functions of reparations, especially now norms about what they're used for, primarily to restore. So if your land was taken away, land is taken back. I mean, given back. Citizenship taken away, citizenship given back. But what if you've lost your family and your loved ones and they can't be replaced? So the stereotypical way we think about reparations then is compensation or money. And then probably the cutting edge of reparations today is called rehabilitation. And that's the health aspect of. So when the International Center for Transitional Justice, I know one of the reparations negotiators, Christian Correa, you know, and he says, when they stopped and asked victims, how might reparations be best designed? They realized that they were not thinking about the different ways that victims of human rights violations are impacted. Okay, so for instance, in the study that I did on Nepal with my colleagues, when they went into the field and they interviewed victims who had received reparations, there was an elderly woman who said, that's not justice. Justice should be, I should be able to kill the son of the person who killed my son. Okay, so now you're facing different cultural notions of what constitutes restorative justice and how reparations are used to achieve that globally. So what NGOs like the ICTJ have started to do is to do focus groups and ask people what would be the best form of reparations for you. And what they've done is people have said, I'm bankrupt. My family is bankrupt from all the medical problems I have from what was done to me. And so reparations can be prosthetics, but it could be building community health centers in places where there are lots of victims and offering them free lifetime medical care. It can be access to mental health care, access to physical medical health care. And in fact, Peru has one of the most extensive sort of programs at reparations at the federal, what we would consider the state and the local level, and has these community level health centers that allow victims to go in for free and use them. In Chicago, they took the idea even further and they built medical centers. And they said, well, because of the length of time that this sort of torture had gone on and everyone knew about it and no one did anything about it and multiple members of families over generations ended up in these torture centers. We're going to build these community health centers, and not only is it free to the victims, but also to their families because we have community level trauma. So getting very creative about what that looks like. So the book is laying out the different functions of reparations, and then the institutional legal landscape. What are the sort of venues where you can pursue reparations? And how do you get there? And then the second half of the book is the political and legal issues that arise. So it is a book that is 18 years in the making. And I was recently awarded a fellowship to work on it at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Relations Scholars here in D.C. So I'll be back for 5 months, or I can just write the book and that's it. Which is very exciting.
One thing. I'm kind of curious about how we determine, and I feel like this might fall more in like the ethics range than the research range, and kind of touch down with the types of reparations, but how do we know when, if ever, the reparations are enough? Like, what defines enough?
That is such a good question. Okay, so if you remember from sort of your basic international relations classes, there is no world government, right? It's an anarchic system, some would assume. If we say there's no world government to protect states, to protect individuals, nor to tell them what to do, there is no overarching entity to legislate on these issues. So the case-by-case basis is really how it's being worked out. So how do you know when it's enough is a question that remains, especially because now these efforts have lasted, especially the ones over time. You have some that, if we think about money, are one-time payments. Some that are like a Social Security program where it's a payment every month. And then those that are in kind, like the end of World War I, World War II, if you took a building in Germany down brick by brick, put it on a ship, the bricks on the ship, send it to the United States and rebuild it. So reparations can be taking that factory and putting it in there. Okay, so how do you know when it's enough? I can't even give you an example where anyone feels that it's enough. I think part of the reason why there's no case of reparations on the planet where every victim received reparations, whatever the form, that they received reparations equally. So not only do you have the contentious politics between victims of human rights who seek reparations or are sometimes awarded it without even seeking it and the rest of society, but contentious politics among victims because of the inequalities. So a really good example of this would be Lebanon, the 2006 war between Israel and Lebanon. At the end of the conflict, there were no peace treaties signed that dealt with reparations, and each accused the other of war crimes. So the Lebanese government didn't have the resources to provide reparations to all of its citizens who were impacted, their homes being destroyed, injuries suffered. So they created a really innovative public policy called the Adoption Plan and allowed non-state actors and state actors from outside of Lebanon to adopt a village or a city or a town and to deal with the effects of the war there. So if schools were destroyed, to rebuild the schools, the sewer system, to rebuild it, homes destroyed, rebuild it. So countries like France, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia adopted small towns. NGOs from all over the world came in, adopted small towns. So you have all these actors who come in, some who have no idea about the politics nor speak the languages, and they're giving different kinds of reparations at different rates to different people, including the government. So it's interesting work that one of my good friends, Fatin Gulsen, has done looking at reparations in the Middle East. Is one of the actors that worked the fastest was Hezbollah. which is little known because it has, we know about sort of the military wing, but not the economic, social, and political wings. And so because of the hadiths in Islam that say, if you harm, you must repair, Hezbollah rebuilt homes destroyed by Israeli rockets faster than any other actor in Lebanon. And in fact, rebuilt the homes technologically more advanced than before to withstand future rocket attacks. So the Lebanese government was the slowest at getting reparations. Some people still haven't gotten it. Within 3 to 6 months, most people in the south whose homes were impacted got reparations from Hezbollah, and then everyone else was in between. And so you have, so you can't even get to the question of is it enough, because some reparations efforts, and oftentimes they say they're going to award reparations, but actually doing it is a very different question. So the set of countries that say pass legislation, say they're going to award reparations, looks like this, and especially if it's money, and the ones that actually pay out looks like this. So it's the ones where there's the reparations have been implemented, because countries will even pass laws to circumvent, like war crimes tribunals, other mechanisms of transitional justice, like war crimes tribunals, truth commissions will recommend reparations. And so, for instance, with truth commissions, they have recommending power. So their purpose is to have eminent people on the Truth Commission whose job it is to conduct an investigation of what happened and the truth of what happened, and to allow victims and perpetrators, alleged victims, alleged perpetrators, to testify as to their experience to build a report. But they can recommend reparations. And so in Peru, reparations were recommended, but then the government at one point passed legislation that said there will be no reparations paid out until all the bodies of the disappeared are found. So how do you know who's disappeared, and how do you know who just walked away? So there have been legal cases, like there was a reparations claim for torture against the Honduras's government in the Inter-American Court for Human Rights. And the family tried to get reparations domestically, couldn't, went to this international court. And the government kept saying, well, how do you know your father has disappeared? What if he just walked away and left and he didn't say anything? So the burden to prove that someone has disappeared and that they were disappearing and killed is a high burden, and domestic legislation can be used to circumvent actual reparations agreements.
To add to that, I'm currently taking a class called Politics and Performance, and we're looking at how, you know, once formal reparations are paid out, like, that doesn't necessarily mean that the community is all healed. Mm-hmm. So we look at how theater and performance tries to build trust again in that community.
Mm-hmm. And art and performance is actually the other cutting edge of reparations, mm-hmm, and thinking about transitional justice. So, and there's this sort of complicated relationship between human rights and art. So on one hand, it's therapeutic. It can help the victims heal, especially there's this whole area now of transitional justice and art and how art can be therapeutic for children. But then what about how art can be stolen, which is part of the violation of, like, a cultural violation, and then how art can be used to facilitate human rights violations. So just like Georgetown is going through dealing with the legacy of slavery here through a means of mechanisms, the University of New Mexico is doing the same. And art is a huge issue at the University of New Mexico. So you have varied issues, like the names of some of the buildings are named after conquistadors. The seal, university seal, reflects conquistadors who killed a lot of people. The university sits on native land. Then you have these murals in the library that were part of the New Deal, art that was put in universities and post offices all over the country, thinking that it was progressive. And so it depicts stereotypes, Native Americans as artisans, Hispanic people as laborers. And then when you get to the scientists who are looking in microscopes, they're white with lab coats. And it ends with this white baby who's blonde, blue-eyed, which this is the 1930s. So some might say that it reflects the ideas of eugenics at the time, of creating the perfect sort of person. And then the last one is this person presumably grown up who is the means for like peace and bringing everything together in the Southwest. There have been protests about these paintings, these murals, since the 1930s. And it's similar to Georgetown, which one of the reasons why it an issue that had been a problem for a very long time, the university did something about, was the protest, student protesters at Georgetown connected these issues to Black Lives Matter. So the Black Lives Matter protests that erupted when Black men were being killed, and there were big cases in Maryland, that there were protests across 22 universities in the United States at the time for discrimination against African Americans on campus. So you have all these national forces going on, and the students were very savvy here and connected it to a broader national context that created the environment that put some pressure probably on the university to do something. Same thing at the University of New Mexico. Since the 1940s, every decade, there have been student protests. And the reason why the university is moving differently, not that it's the first time it's trying to do something, is because of the protests and the taking down of the Civil War monuments, which raised similar questions. So the student protester said, well, if those monuments are being taken down all over the country with the argument that their existence is traumatizing and misrepresenting history, then these library murals have to come down. So students started protesting again. And I think what has to happen, I mean, I'm actually moving into the work, and I think this will be my next book, is looking at how universities confront the past. So I have the opportunity to be here at Georgetown and to sort of see what's happening. I created this course on transitional justice and reparations internationally and domestically for the Department of Government. So I get a chance to talk to students, and I've invited members of the working group. We have a descendant coming to class to learn more about this case. And I've been appointed to the university level task force at the University of New Mexico to work on sort of the myriad of issues there and how to address them. And right now the salient one is these murals. And they're complicated because not only were they created by a federal program, they put UNM on the map as a national landmark. So you can't even move them a millimeter without violating some law about how they should be managed. So the demands by students, by the librarians, it has created a toxic workspace. They say, just take it down. They've been vandalized. Students, Native American and Hispanic, won't even study in that area of the library, and it's public art. So you don't have the agency to say, I don't want to look at it, or I want to look at it, because you have to walk past it. So, so that's happening at the same time. And to show you, to go back to art, but then culture, what the University of New Mexico has done, and I think Georgetown also, is to negotiate what restorative justice looks like in the context of that case. So there, one of the issues was anthropologists were taking burial masks and totem poles from Native American tribes. And so the university decided that it was time to atone for this. And there was a totem pole that had been taken away from a tribe in Vancouver. So they wanted to return it, but the tribe said, it's been tainted now. We can't take it back. So they negotiated what restorative justice would look like culturally. So they did a ceremony to cleanse the totem pole. They said, the tribe said, we can't take it back, but if you make a replica, we can take that. We'll have artists from the tribe come and restore the original and give it to the family. And then the president apologized at the university level. And so this is not uncommon. And I think what we don't have a sense of, we tend to think of universities confronting their past with a legacy of slavery, which is very true in this part of the country and for universities that have a Catholic connection, because the Catholic Church did engage in slavery and then outlawed it and said it didn't condone the sale of human beings. I was raised Catholic, so this is really interesting for me. But then when you get to the Southwest, it's the legacy of settler colonialism and violence towards Native American and Hispanic communities, and then the conflicts between Native Americans and Hispanic. So I'm someone who comes from a Black-white context and understanding the nature of human rights violations, the role of place. What also is very different there is you have people whose families have been there for 500 years. So they preceded the United States, New Mexico becoming a part of the United States, and the existence of the University of New Mexico. So their arguments are, you have no authority because we were here first. So it's very, very different. And then right now at the University of Southern California, they're dealing with the issue of Japanese Americans who are interned in camps. The University of Southern California expelled students who are Japanese American and in internment camps, expelled them from the university. So I just gave a talk there. I had no idea about this. And so what's being negotiated now is what would some sort of restorative justice reparations look like. So at first it was, well, we will give degrees to the individuals who had been here and put in internment camps. But the alumni said, but you didn't complete your studies. So they're negotiating a certificate that acknowledges their presence. So these are all, and to get back to the University of New Mexico, we understand it in Bosnia, people will fight over memorials, the civilians versus the national military, and whose story of what happened in this massacre is correct. People are willing to fight and die for. It's similar here. I mean, in New Mexico, the students have gotten death threats for protesting. The campus-wide class that's been created to talk about these issues and allow students to put forth proposals to try to address concretely, to come up with ways to resolve these issues, it's contentious. And it's come from a variety of different actors who feel like their memory is being challenged, taken away, important artwork for their culture, so not just settler history, but UNM history. And it's actually a contentious issue in New Mexico. But we focus so much on what happens in other places in the world, we're missing what happens domestically. I would say the forefront of reparations in the United States right now, if we're talking about African-American reparations, I think the big issues are police brutality, because there's always this debate about the harm of slavery. Can it be demonstrated today? Which we can do, but it always has been an impediment to talking about reparations. But police brutality as an issue that the African-American community deals with from the time we were brought here as enslaved Africans, and police patrols, slave patrols that would capture Northerners or escape slaves and take them to the South and force them into slavery, has been consistent, continuous, and systematic. It's probably one of the strongest case areas, I think, for African-American reparations. And then universities confronting the past, because they're not governments, they're non-state actors. And as a function of the social movement forces going on in the United States, there are many universities confronting their past. We just don't know about it.
I think we have to wrap up soon.
see, it's on a, like, my personal opinion. That I find interesting that we kind of touched on. It's hard for me to look at reparation, like change the name of a building or something, and see it as enough when we still have so much discrimination going on today.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that's where our focus needs to be.
I think that is a great point. And I think when we look at, and this is something I'm writing about, and I'll make it quick because I know we have to go, but reparations efforts, they're often not reparations for one thing, and they're often evolutionary. So if you want to know, like, this is why the Holocaust case is so important, because you have reparations through international treaties, reparations through individual claims, through public policies. So there is, because it wasn't enough, and because at the time, at the end of World War II, the focus was on material loss and not trauma, until the 1990s, we couldn't talk about that. So you saw over time more and more reparations for still the Holocaust. And most of them are like that. Because of the issue is not enough, if everyone hasn't been addressed the first time, then there are political forces that keep coming back and saying, well, what about this? What about that? On the other side, and I'll leave you with some of the hard questions about reparations, is what is enough? Are inequalities and inequities created by reparations programs that can create new tensions and conflict among people? And we're so stuck at the beginning, we don't even get to enough or the adverse consequences of reparations. I'm in trouble.
I was actually wondering about, like, the Me Too movement and, like, what, like, reparations would look like in that case, of, like, gosh, institutionalized, like, sexual harassment and all of that.
Oh, my God. That is such a great question. Okay, so I kind of have to go back to talk about gender and reparations. So historically, the things that happened to women were not considered war crimes, were not considered as bad as torture. So if you rape, which has historically been used as a weapon in war, if you were sexually mutilated in war, your breasts were cut off, a gun was used to rape you, just all kinds of things, that wasn't considered as bad as the torture that men go through. So transitional justice was, in the 1990s, very gendered, where mostly men got reparations and women didn't. And so, or even like in Sierra Leone, you suffer the same crime, but because men are the main income earners, they get more reparations than women, or reparations at all, based on who's the income earner and who isn't. So the cutting edge of transitional justice today is thinking about gender and the ways that women have been impacted, and sexual violence, and how do we structure transitional justice reparations programs so that they're not re-traumatizing women. So if the reparations, let's say, is money, they put it in a bank account. But you live in a country where a woman can't have a bank account, so that she has to rely on a man to have the bank account and give her the money. The structures of society are re-traumatizing them again. So this is kind of where we are now. And also, it's gone to the other extreme. Some practitioners will say that women can suffer a broad range of violations, but they may only get reparations for sexual violence. Okay, so now what does that mean for Me Too? Me Too is a powerful moment. I think we have to keep in mind a couple things. 50% of the planet now are women, 50% of the population. So when people say, why is this happening now? Why is this happening now? I have even heard people say, well, it's just, you know, now women are going after men. This has been pervasive across the planet, across class, across time. As we've seen, most women have some kind of story. And I think it's come to the fore because not only do we have, in terms of population size, so many women, but also now women in power who have economic resources, who have political power, and tired of these things happening and not having a venue to say anything and nor to do anything. So what is her name, the singer who sang at the Grammys, who was involved in a legal case? And so there were two actresses.
Kesha,
who put forward money to help her in her case. And the current Rose McGowan, that might have been it. Rose McGowan signed a confidentiality agreement when she took a settlement, and if she spoke about it, she had to return the money. So two actresses put forth the money to pay it back so that she would be free to speak. So women using their economic resources to provide an opportunity for space. Now, what would reparations look like? So one of the problems in the American context is we get stuck in thinking about reparations as money. And when we start talking about how pervasive sexual harassment has been across every aspect of society, I worry that we get stuck in money the way that it's happened with African-American reparations. And if we can be creative and think about what reparations might look like given the harm, do we have institutional mechanisms put in place in professions, in companies, in universities that specifically provide a safe space for women to come forward and invest money that way? Do we provide psychological and medical care for women who have suffered psychological trauma, physical trauma, especially if they've been raped and suffer sexual violence? Do we provide resources for their care, recognizing, as they do in the rest of the world, that you might need psychological care for the rest of your life, but you don't have resources for it? I mean, in the case of Dr. Larry Nassar, this is one of the issues. The victims who've come forward, who did not take settlements at all, they're struggling with, I need psychological care and I need it ongoing and I don't have the resources to provide for it. So maybe if we map out, you know, what were the kinds of violations that women have suffered that are constitute the Me Too movement, be creative about how can we address those particular harms, then reparations could be constructed to deal specifically with what women have encountered. That's one way to think about it.
One final question. What's your advice for women going into human rights law or transitional justice?
Okay, so one of the things, there's actually a couple things I would like to say. So thank you for asking that. I would like to say is the study of conflict is different today than during the Cold War. Political scientists, because we conceptualize conflict as war between two countries, when we wanted to understand why countries went to war, we would interview the Secretary of State, Minister of Defense, something like that. But now that conflict involves so many non-state actors and is oftentimes within countries, between groups of the state and groups, we have to go inside of the conflict and we have to interview conflict participants, the combatants, to understand how conflict works. So I have a student who has done work in Uganda, and she went into the north where the conflict is happening to interview ex-combatants who were child soldiers at 5 and didn't come out until they were 35 or 40. And how do you reintegrate them back into society? So the safety of women who study human rights, who study conflict, who have to go into the most dangerous places in the world with no protection. We tend to think about journalists and their safety, but we don't think about academics who go in with no protection, sometimes no institutional affiliation other than their universities and a small grant and whatever they have in their pocket, and they go in. And one of the phenomena that's starting to come to light in comparative politics, international relations, and political science is the sexual violence that female academics suffer when they go into the field. Oftentimes raped, traumatized, sexually mutilated, lots of different things that happen. And for people, period. I mean, it's a phenomena for all political scientists because the nature of conflict has changed where there's lots of non-state actors. So even for men, there's dangers. There was a graduate student who was killed in Egypt last summer who was doing research on state repression. So I would say one is the safety of academics, especially women when they're going into societies where women have no rights and women have no protections. How do they protect themselves? And I think at a disciplinary level, we are finally becoming aware of this and starting to think about it. So I would say our human rights and protecting us. And how do you do that? I mean, every other summer I take students from UNM to Berlin to study human rights. And we just meet there. And I was there over the summer when the terrorist attack during the Ariana Grande concert happened, the terrorist attack on the London Bridge, the knife attack. So I was in London. Then we went to Germany, my family and I, and then we went back to London. And so it was, okay, we are here. These terrorist attacks are happening like in a 3-week period. I had to think about the safety issues for the students, for myself. More and more there's training that happens before you go. So I would say the safety issues of studying conflict and human rights. And also there's more women than ever in comparative politics and international relations, especially young women who are going into these dangerous spaces to answer these questions, especially about not just women as victims in conflict, but now looking at women as agents. When are they insurgents? There's questions about like leadership roles in rebel groups, insurgencies, freedom fighters, things like that, the complexity, the complex range of roles that we can have. I was saying the other part of this is the responsibility that we have. Human rights conflict is a different sort of area, especially when you start talking about collecting data. What is the data that we're collecting? So on one hand, it could be, you know, from the government's perspective, how well it's complying with international human rights law and the laws of war. But also we have data on numbers of victims of certain types of crimes per country. And I didn't realize what that meant until I was at Sachsenhausen concentration camp in Berlin. And they have a sign when you walk in that says, please be respectful. Tens of thousands of people have died here. And I stood in the middle of the camp and I saw the spreadsheets that we have, that these lives get boiled down to numbers of deaths and kinds of deaths. But that the more data we have, so first people suffered, so we have data to study this. And the more data we have, the new data we have, that means that more people are suffering. So I think there's a special responsibility that you have when you study human rights. And that is that you can't, your career can't just benefit from the publications that come from using this data, but you have to do something and you have to help in some way. And I tell my students that work with me, you can't work with me if you also don't find a way to work on human rights in practice. So I have one student who is at UNM, who's now in Notre Dame's PhD program. She does work on Bosnia. And she's like, I really saw what you were saying when she went to Bosnia, because Western researchers came there right after the genocide, the 1990s wars in Yugoslavia. And they did research. They didn't build any academic institutions. They didn't share their research techniques with academics there. And they took the data and they took the information, they left and they published and they built these careers. And so when she went, people were like not welcoming at all. Here's another Western, American researcher or Western European researcher who's going to take this and not help us. And now she feels a very strong obligation that if she studies this part, the Balkans, she must do something to deal with the human rights issues. So I would say the ways that we're vulnerable in the field and the responsibilities that we have when we move into this field, probably because I dealt with trade data first. And it wasn't at the level of human beings. And so I realized, because I've dealt with this different kind of data, the responsibility that you have because of whose experience it represents.
Thank you so much.
Wow, that's a lot.
I feel like here's my heart. I just gave it to you. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to come and tell my story. I really appreciate it.
We really appreciate you
telling us about this. Yes.
You are welcome. I would say probably the most important thing to learn about my life. I mean, yes, I worked hard. But, you know, mentors come in forms and people you don't expect. And I really benefited from people who saw value in me or what I was saying, who also took chances on me. And I would say to survive in academia, no one does it alone, because you have to have people that mentor, that advocate for your cause, just given the structure of PhD exams, dissertations, things like that. And if I could say, I would like to say thank you to every single person that helped me, my friends in graduate school who saved my life when I couldn't breathe and I was stubborn, I didn't want to go to a hospital. and my family who stuck with me. One issue I wanted to address is, you know, as a working mom, how am I able to do what I do? How is it that I can hold a tenured appointment at the University of New Mexico and also be an adjunct professor at Georgetown University for a couple weeks each semester, each year? And I wanted to make sure that I made the point that I have a very supportive family, my immediate family, my extended family, and the village. And I think this is important because what I'm doing can't be done alone. I'm really fortunate that my husband, Sheldon Jordan, is a biomedical scientist and a very involved father who, while I'm gone, you know, really takes great care of our daughters, Alessandra and Ariana, so that I can be here. And our daughters are 8 and 7, and so I've been doing this for about 3 years now, so it's not easy for them when mom's gone. And they're really supportive. One of the things that's really great is technology, virtual technology, that allows me to FaceTime with them in the morning when they first wake up, and at night right before they go to bed, and anytime in between if we have the chance. Which I think closes the distance a bit, but also grandparents. And so Sheldon's mom, my parents, really step up in terms of helping with picking up the girls from school, watching them when Sheldon works, stepping up where necessary for the times that I'm gone. So I would just like to acknowledge that there is a very supportive network behind me that helps me, that believes in what I'm doing, that makes all of this possible. And I'm really grateful. And I think that as women try to figure out how to do innovative things in their field, we oftentimes have to be willing to accept help from others, which is pretty difficult if you're a strong woman who's used to sort of trying to handle things on your own, to recognize that you need help. And to take it when it's offered and give it when it's needed.
Thank you all for listening. Follow us on Twitter at GTown Voice and at Halftime GU. Emily's is at MLE Jaster and mine is at KAEI_LI. You can find more podcasts on the GeorgetownVoice.com website or subscribe to the Voice Podcast Network on iTunes.